This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. My name is Daniel Aiken, and this week we're fortunate to be joined once again by our good friend Bhikkhu Bodhi. In this episode, Bhikkhu Bodhi tells us about his latest book, The Buddha's Teachings on Social and Communal Harmony, and how this book came about from real needs from within various Buddhist communities. Bhikkhu Bodhi explains how the Buddhist teachings hold the key to promoting communal peace, tolerance, and understanding. He also tells us about the Buddha's daily routine as explained in the suttas. In addition, we discuss a variety of words that the Buddha used to refer to meditation, and what he meant, for example, when he talked about mindfulness. So I hope you enjoy this episode.
I started working on this book back in, I believe it was the year 2011. I was contacted by Robert Thurman, who wrote to me and said that somebody from, at Columbia University, there's an institute called, I think, the Institute of Peace Studies. And he said that somebody from this institute would be contacting me about a project that they're working on. And he asked me to please help them. Then shortly afterwards, I got an email from the person who was at the Institute of Peace at Columbia. And he said that they had been developing programs to promote intercommunal harmony in Sri Lanka amongst the different ethnic factions. This was the period soon after the end of the ethnic war between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers. And they were working to bring the community, they're trying to bring the communities together. And he said that they had developed a kind of workbook for the use in the general society. But what they wanted to do was to involve the monks more in promoting intercommunal harmony. And so he wanted me to provide them with some texts from the Pali suttas that would be conducive to this, to their project. And so I started looking through the suttas and trying to find texts that would be useful for promoting communal harmony. And then somehow, gradually, an outline took shape in my mind, whereby first I had texts that deal with, or headings that deal with sort of the foundations for communal harmony. And then I think I had right view at the beginning, then moral conduct, right speech, good friendship, and then moving into the Buddha's teachings, dealing with, you know, promoting harmony within the Sangha, dealing with conflict in the Sangha. And then I organized all of these, or put the text together under these headings, and sent it off to this person at the Buddhist Peace, at the Institute for Peace Studies at Columbia. I don't know whether they ever used it. I have the suspicion that they wanted me to actually create a workbook for use by the monks rather than a selection of suttas. But I just kept the collection of texts, I just kept it on my computer. And then shortly after I compiled it, Alan Sanoki, who is living in Berkeley, California, and he has been working with communities both in Burma and in India trying to promote ethnic harmony amongst communities there. And he asked me if I could provide him with some texts from the Pali Canon that are conducive to promoting communal harmony. Then I told him, well, I have exactly the thing that you need already prepared. And I sent it off to him. And he said, wow, this is exactly what I was looking for. And he started to use it amongst groups that he was working with in Burma. And in fact, it was already in the initial form, the initial draft of the collection. He had translated into Burmese and published in Burma. And they did publish also an English language version of that. And then I think it was Alan who suggested I should get it published in the United States. Then I believe I wrote to Tim and asked whether he was interested in something like that, and he said he was.
Fantastic. So this book came out of a real need. about and to do with like communal harmony in Buddhist communities and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, it has broader implications than just for use in Buddhist communities. Yeah.
And so and
then, then last September 2015, there's a group, it's called the Community Dharma Leaders Training Program. Gina Sharp is involved with this, a number of other people. And they were having a gathering of their trainees at the Garrison Institute in upstate New York. And she asked me if I would come to speak to the group one afternoon. And I said I would be happy to do so. This was September. And then I was thinking about a theme to use. And so I decided to use some of the ideas in this book. And I told them about the upcoming book. And then I presented some of the themes that I dealt with in the book. And the group was just so, you know, enthusiastic about this idea. It said, you know, that there's nothing really out
there
that's dealing with this topic. Yeah. And so they asked me, when is it? One of the participants said, the only question I have is when it's going to come out.
Soon.
And then I said that Andy at Wisdom said that he's going to push it up early on the production line.
Great.
So I should, as I said it, I assume it will be coming out in the spring of 2016.
Fantastic. Well,
but then he told me later, well, we have it scheduled for the fall of 2016.
And so it feels like there's a real need, but there's a little bit of an urgency around this, the Buddha's advice on social harmony. And you also, in the book, you talk a little bit about interpersonal conflict and how to deal with that. And so what you've sort of gathered is, you know, this is not the Buddha's teachings on how to become awakened.
Yeah,
it's more the Buddha's teachings on how to have harmony in our day-to-day life at various levels. And it's interesting that you start the book with right view.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was wondering what right view means in this context.
Yeah, in that context, I took right view not in what I would call the higher sense. You know, we make a distinction sometimes, this is in the Pali commentarial tradition, between Lokiya Samaditti, mundane right view, which is the understanding of the workings of karma and its fruit, the belief or the acceptance of the idea of that we live multiple lives and that our actions in this life have consequences going beyond this life and future lives. So a distinction between the Lokiya or mundane right view and the Lokuttara right view, that's the world transcending right view, which would be like the insight into the three characteristics, dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths. So the right view that we're concerned with from the aspect of promoting social harmony is the mundane right view, understanding that our actions do have consequences that go beyond our life here and now, that they do leave imprints within the stream of consciousness that will bear fruit either later in this life or in future lives. So when one understands the workings of the law of karma, then one sees the need to restrain one's impulses towards anger, hatred, generating conflict, and to work towards promoting, you know, qualities like kindness, collaboration with others, patience.
And then how do you put that into words for non-Buddhists? How do you explain, you know, this sort of right view in terms of, like, if you're talking about either on a personal level, you know, how do people get along and in just in relationships, for example? And I noticed that you said, like, so in Buddhism, Buddhism sees that personal transformation as the key to the transformation of society.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that?
I would say that two aspects, this is speaking a little bit beyond the scope of the Buddha's actual teaching, and I would say that the two aspects have to be sort of balanced against each other. One is that the transformation of society depends upon the transformation of individuals, individual consciousness, so that, you know, if people are motivated by greed, personal ambition, by prejudices and biases, by anger and hatred, then when you get sort of the collective massing of people whose attitudes are governed by those factors, then you're bound to get conflict and disharmony in society. Whereas when you see, when people understand the benefits that come from restraint, collaboration, patience, and then you have the amalgamation of people with these attitudes, then that will conduce to a harmonious society. So this is the emphasis, because the Buddha is primarily a spiritual teacher. So that is the aspect that he emphasizes. But I think the other aspect also has to be taken into account, particularly today, when we have, when people's attitudes are generated by or conditioned by mass media, and when the mass media are in under the control of vested interests, which are promoting their own agendas, that the social collective also conditions the personal attitudes of people. And so it's not sufficient, I would say, just for people to aim at their own inner personal change, because then spirituality becomes a very private affair, but rather as people who participate in a social order, we also have to aim at social and collective change. And then that will bounce back and change the attitudes of people at the individual level.
So do you think that's something that's changed, you know, from when the Buddha's time to now? That's a different environment, and maybe the Buddha would have been talking to that level as well?
I think definitely, very definitely, that would be the case. I think in the Buddha's time, of course, there was, you know, organized and integrated societies, but the dominant form of government, or there were two dominant forms of government. One was the old tribal republics, which were sort of aristocratic republics in which the control of the state was, or the state was controlled and public affairs were controlled by the elite of the aristocratic elite, which was the Sakyan community was one such state. The Lichavi Confederation was another. But then the form of government that was rising and coming to increasing dominance in the Buddha's time was monarchy. And so decisions were, actually there is that an aspect to that in the Buddha's teaching. So the decisions in the monarchies, of course, rested with the king. And the Buddha tried, you know, he couldn't promote public opinion the way we would do today. But what he tried to do was to transform the ideals of kingship by promoting the ideal of what he calls the Chakravarti Raja, the wheel-turning king, whose reign is to be governed. That he taught that the wheel-turning king has a sovereign above himself, and that sovereign is Dhamma. Dhamma understood not specifically as the Buddha's teaching in the narrow sense, but Dhamma in the broader Indian sense of the law, I call the cosmic law of righteousness and truth. And so the king, in order to reign, to for his reign to be justified, has to rule in accordance with this cosmic law of righteousness and truth.
So morality is the king of kings.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm wondering, in the book it talks about how the Buddha mentioned that anger and resentment is the chief sort of obstacle to social harmony. Do you think in today's world that would, the Buddha would have the same sort of commentary, or other things like greed?
I don't know that. Did I actually say that anger is the chief obstacle to social
harmony? It may have been in the introduction, but it might be not be the chief, but it's certainly
pointed
out.
I think I would have said that anger is one of the primary obstacles, but certainly I wouldn't say that it is necessarily the chief. And I would agree that today greed is probably, and greed in a very broad sense, not necessarily just greed for money, but the grasping after power, control, and domination, and greed for money as being one of the means to cement one's control and domination, has ascended in its significance yeah. as a factor. Well, what has to be done? Well, this is gets into the subtleties of political manipulation. But for those in power to maintain their hold on power, one of the instruments by which they do this to keep people distracted from recognizing their plight and to prevent them from collaborating to promote their common interest, the means by which they do this is by sowing conflict and resentment amongst the general population. Yeah. So we could see this, I mean, in the, I guess we're not supposed to be political, but within the Republican yeah. presidential campaign.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, from, you know, it's sort of like greed, then resentment, then
yeah,
anger.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because also there's a whole section on right speech, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
right and right speech at many levels.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, yeah. you know, when I'm thinking about myself and my friends and my social group,
yeah.
where, you know, the problem isn't necessarily like, you know, my friends and that aren't out there physically harming people.
Yeah.
But a lot of pain is caused through speech.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so this idea of right speech, I think, is an important message.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
even at, like, you hinted at, like, the media.
Yeah.
And so there's various levels of yeah. right speech.
Yeah.
So what does the Buddha, what advice does the Buddha have for us on right speech?
Yeah. In fact, in the chapter on right speech, I went beyond the canonical definition. I think I made a distinction between right speech and proper speech. Mm. So within, say, the structure of the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech is one of the eight factors, and the Buddha gives a specific definition of right speech in that context, which is abstaining from false speech, from divisive speech, speech which creates conflicts between people, from harsh or angry speech, and then from idle chatter. So that is right speech in the narrow sense, but then in a broader sense, I brought in even the way to criticize another person.
Yeah.
So the Buddha lays down certain conditions when, and this is within the monastic order, say, when one monk wants to criticize another, then he should do so bearing in mind five factors. And I have to test my memory to see whether I can remember all five of them. One is to make sure that what is said is true, not false, to make sure that he does speaks to the other person at the proper time. You know, if the other person is in a group of friends, one doesn't want to start criticizing them amongst their friends, so it'll embarrass them. To speak with a mind of loving kindness, not with a mind of anger and hatred. To speak gently, not harshly, and then to speak with the intention of benefiting the other, not of harming the other.
Yeah, what? Imagine that people took that on, and what conflict would be avoided and misunderstandings just by abiding by those five ways of speaking correctly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And related to that, there's this idea of, you know, being a good friend.
Yeah, that's another separate chapter within the book. Yeah.
And what does it mean to be a good friend?
Again, the Buddha speaks of good friendship to different people in different contexts, like in the sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Sigalovada Sutta. This is sutta number 31 in the Digha Nikaya. He's speaking to a young Brahmin student named Sigalika. And so he speaks about good friendship under many different categories. He speaks about the helpful friend, I think the friend who's compassionate, the friend who helps one in times of need, the friend who advises one properly. And then under each general heading, he has like four or five aspects. So it's broken down into numerical lists of the constituents of good friendship. So that is when the Buddha is speaking to like a young lay person. Then within the monastic context, he speaks about the good friend as being the one who advises one in the development of sila or moral conduct, the undertaking or generation of energy, the development of samadhi or concentration, who imparts the principles of wisdom. You know, so the way good friendship function, good friendship operates depends on the context. But earlier I had reflected on the nature of good friendship, and then I distinguished what I call two aspects of good friendship. One is what I call the horizontal good friendship, and that is this, what I call the spiritual friendship, which takes place between people who are roughly peers on the path, those who are practicing the path together, roughly at the same level of development. And then the second aspect of good friendship is what I call vertical good friendship, and that is the relationship of spiritual friendship that takes place between somebody who functions in the position of a teacher or a spiritual guide and his students or disciples. And so, you know, good friendship will operate differently in that context from the way it will operate between those who are, you know, treading the path together roughly at the same level.
And so I think, you know, monastic living,
yeah,
is, so the Buddha, you know, gave advice for monastics on how to live together.
Yeah.
And so that is a certain, you know, a particular type of communal living.
Yeah.
And so do you, I noticed that you selected, you know, from the Sutta Pitaka rather than the Vinaya Pitaka.
Yeah.
It was that on because of that, or what was the decision informing where to go in the Buddha's words for this selections?
Well, certainly the Sutta Pitaka has advice which is much more generally applicable than the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya Pitaka will deal with much more with the specifics of the monastic rules and regulations. And so occasionally in the Vinaya, one will find pieces of advice which are more general, but those same passages will also occur in the Sutta Pitaka.
Okay.
Yeah, so for example, I think there's the text on the six causes of disputes, and then the counterpart to that are the six causes of, or six principles that lead to harmony and respect. One will find those in the Vinaya Pitaka, but also in the Sutta Pitaka. But many of the other passages, more general passages, will come from the Sutta Pitaka, not from the Vinaya Pitaka.
So then the Buddha was giving advice to monastics and how to live harmoniously in a community.
Yeah.
He also gave counsel to kings, as you mentioned.
Right.
And I was wondering what you thought, what the Buddha might have given to today's world leaders. What would be some of the advice he might have imparted to today's world leaders? What are your thoughts on that?
I think a lot of them he would have simply showed the door to the exit with the exit sign. But I would say that he would teach that their primary responsibility as leaders is to promote the well-being and happiness of the people in their nations, and not to do so in ways which are prejudicial to the well-being and happiness of people in other countries. So he would say that their primary responsibility is to promote the, at the first level, the material well-being of people in the country. In fact, I think this is one of the duties of the ruler, according to the Buddha's teaching, is to ensure that there is economic prosperity throughout the land. And there is there are actually two suttas to that effect that I could think of offhand in the Sutta Pitaka, both in the Digha Nikaya. One occurs in Sutta number 5. It's called the Kutadanda Sutta, which is sort of set in the legendary past, where there is a king whose realm is plagued by bandits, rebels and bandits who are raiding the countryside and causing havoc in the realm. And the king thinks that the way to remedy the situation is to perform a great sacrifice. And so he turns to his chaplain, you know, like his prime minister, who it turns out is actually the future Buddha. This is the Bodhisattva in a past life, to get advice on how he should perform the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And then the chief minister said, or the chaplain says, "Your Majesty, it would be futile to perform a sacrifice to remedy this problem in your realm. The reason why there's so much confusion and chaos and banditry in your realm is because people are poor. Mm. And when they're poor, then the only way they can maintain themselves is by robbing others." So he says, to get rid of this problem in your realm, the solution is to, and he's very specific, he says, to give seed to farmers so that they can grow their crops, to give loans to merchants and businessmen so they could start their businesses, and to provide adequate salaries to the government workers so that they can maintain themselves and their families. And then the king takes the minister's advice, and then all of the banditry stops and people are happy and there's no more chaos in the realm. And then there's another sutta which is along a similar line, where the Buddha teaches that one of the primary responsibilities of the king is to ensure that there's no poverty in the realm. So I say that one of the primary responsibilities for rulers of the present day is to adopt measures to ensure that there is no poverty within their countries.
Within their country.
Yeah, and to do so, since the Buddha says that it's the responsibility of the king to do this, this would imply that today, with our democratic systems of governance, that it's the responsibility of the government to take measures to ensure that there is what I would call redistribution of income, to ensure that everybody has a livable, a satisfactory standard of living. Mm-hmm. And then I would also say that the other important measure that should be taken by rulers is to adopt policies which are conducive to peace rather than to warfare.
Yeah.
And then probably a third factor, since that was not foreseen in the Buddha's time, is the problem of climate change.
Yeah.
But we could use Buddha's principles to extrapolate from the suttas to say that the Buddha would advocate turning from reliance on dirty sources of energy to clean sources of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so certainly the Buddha does speak to wealth inequality and within a certain realm.
Yeah.
And now we're in a world where, you know, it's much more global.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I imagine that the Buddha would expand that advice to the rulers, to presidents and prime ministers that they should look after.
Yeah.
Like, so for example, if the Buddha, imagine the Buddha meeting Obama or another world leader and they're discussing ISIS, for example.
Yeah.
What might the Buddha say to these world leaders?
You know, I can't really put ideas in the mind of the Buddha.
Yeah,
but it's a problem I've pondered myself. Mm. Mm. And I don't like any idea of advocating military action.
Yes.
And I think the courses of action which are being taken by present leaders, the idea that the way to deal with ISIS is just to bomb them into oblivion, it's not going to work. We have to find out why such ideas, you know, this fundamentalist, militant, belligerent form of Islam has arisen in the first place, and why it proves so attractive. So that's the first issue.
Yeah.
The second issue, why it proves very attractive to young Muslims.
Yeah.
And then third, at a more pragmatic level, find out how ISIS is getting its funding and its military equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem like a similar question to the sutta you mentioned. You know, these bandits, right? The actions you are taking are futile.
Yeah.
And the Buddha's response for the bandits in the realm was that they need the basic human needs fulfilled.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So speaking about wealth inequality and education and globalization, your organization, can you talk a little bit about that nonprofit that you support?
Okay, this goes back to the period of about 2008, where one of the problems that had been troubling me about the way Buddhism is manifested in the United States it's become, or it seemed to me to become very much an individualistic, personal and private quest for inner cultivation, inner peace, happiness, realization, without sufficient attention to what I would call the global, the vast global dimensions of suffering, which are afflicting billions of people around the world. Particularly, I was reading, you know, about, well, the impact of the war in the Middle East upon, you know, hundreds and thousands, millions of people, and about the extent, what I had witnessed when I lived in Asia, the extent of poverty in Asia. And yet people just seem to be, the conversations that I heard amongst Buddhists, completely oblivious to this dimension of suffering. And so I was speaking to some of my Buddhist friends about this, and they said that they had been thinking exactly along the same lines. And so we had some discussions, what could we do about this? And so we decided to form a Buddhist relief organization, which we came to call Buddhist Global Relief. And so we started BGR in 2008, and now it's close to, well, over 7 years since we started. And after we started Buddhist Global Relief, we set ourselves a very ambitious initial mission, which was to address the problems of poverty, societal neglect of people around the world. But we soon found that that was just too broad a mission. Mm-hmm. And so we had to narrow down the mission to focus on a particular, you know, to establish a particular niche for ourselves. And so one of the problems that we decided to focus on is, or the specific problem we decided to focus on, is the problem of global hunger, mm-hmm. chronic hunger and malnutrition. And so we started, you know, with projects which provided food aid to needy populations. But then over the next year or so, I started to ponder, like, what is the underlying roots of hunger and malnutrition? And investigating this issue, one of the factors that I found, you know, through reading reports on the internet, is the subordinate status of women and girls in many traditional cultures. And so, according to the same reports, the key to advancing or to alleviating poverty and to promoting greater food security in these societies is to promote the education of girls and to give women, poor women, the opportunities to start their own livelihood projects to earn more to support their families. And so we started to support projects that promote the education of poor girls. And the way we work, we don't have people to send to these different countries.
Yeah.
We find organizations that are working in these countries, and then we establish partnerships with them. And so in Cambodia, we found a US-based organization called Lotus Outreach, which actually comes under sort of the general direction of a Bhutanese Lama, the one who makes the film.
Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche.
The film about
the... He directed the cup, yeah?
The cup, the cup,
yeah. Yes.
Okay. So they work in Cambodia, Lotus Outreach, and so we partnered with them on... They have a project called GATE, which is an acronym representing girls' access to education. Mm-hmm. And so the way this project works is that we provide rice support. You see, in many of the poor families, once the girl reaches adolescence, late adolescence, they'll compel her to drop out of school in order to start working to support the family. And many of these girls, if they're forced to drop out, they'll wind up in brothels. Mm-hmm. And so the way the project works is that we provide rice support to the family on condition that they allow the girls to remain in school. Mm-hmm. And so we started this, I think, 2009. And now quite a number of these girls, about 100 of these girls, have finished their high school education, have gone on. Now they're in college and university. So we have a project like that in Cambodia.
Wonderful.
A similar project in Vietnam is supporting the education of poor children, both boys and girls, and a project in India The partner organization is called the Bodhicitta Foundation, which is set up and run by an Australian Buddhist nun named Aya Yeshe. Yeah. And it's based in Nagpur. And so she has established a hostel for girls where they take, I think they've gotten 30 girls from poor, these are the communities that used to be called the outcasts, the Dalit community,
yeah,
where they're training them to become community leaders.
Oh yeah, Sister Yeshe's work, yeah.
Yeah, Sister, Yeshe.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah.
So how does someone listening to the Wisdom Podcast support Buddhist Global Relief? Where should they go?
Yeah, they can learn more about our projects, and over the 7 years of our existence, I think we've launched something in the neighborhood of 70 or 80 projects already.
Okay.
We usually have about 20 projects a year running.
So we'll put links to Buddhist Global Relief.
Yeah, on you can find it on our website, okay. BuddhistGlobalRelief.org.
Okay, so if people go to Buddhist Podcast, wisdompubs.org/podcast, we'll put the links to Buddhist Global Relief.
Yeah, we appreciate that very much. Yeah.
Great. So I think then maybe we'll just... maybe we'll talk about what you're currently working on.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about the translation of the...
Yeah, I've been doing a translation of the Sutta Nipata, which is a collection of texts in within the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon. It's been translated several times already. There's quite an accurate scholarly translation by K.R. Norman, published by the Pali Text Society. Mm-hmm. But his primary interest was... he's not so much a Buddhist scholar, but a philologist. So his approach to the text is that of a philologist.
Yes, yeah.
And so I thought, that I would translate it from the standpoint of a Buddhist, a committed Buddhist and a practitioner. Mm-hmm. But I also thought that there's a large commentary that goes along with the text that explains every verse, both from the standpoint of terminology and meaning. So I also translated the commentary along with the Sutta Nipata. Mm-hmm. The commentary is something like 600 pages of Pali. And then there are two chapters of the Sutta Nipata, chapter 4 and chapter 5, each of which has its own ancient commentary that is included in the Sutta Pitaka. And I took substantial excerpts from each of those canonical commentaries and embedded them within the commentarial section of the work.
And how does this collection fit in with the other collections? So long discourses, connected discourses. How will this fit in with that?
Yeah, well, the Pali Sutta Pitaka consists of five collections or nikayas. Mm-hmm. And the first four are organized connections or connections which center around a particular organizing principle. But the fifth collection is called the Kudaka Nikaya, which means minor collection, but it actually contains more text than the other collections, because it seems that every group of suttas that didn't fit into the other Nikayas got put into the Kudaka Nikaya. And so the Sutta Nipata is one particular collection that is included in the Kudaka Nikaya. And it seems that the Sutta Nipata itself as a collection is specific to the Theravada school or the Pali school, but texts from the Sutta Nipata are found within the canonical literature of other schools, but not collected into a single work like the Sutta Nipata.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the themes that are taken up?
It's very, very varied, the Sutta Nipata. In fact, I haven't yet worked this out, but I've been trying to devise for the introduction headings for the different topics that are dealt with, and then classifying each of the suttas according to the topics that it deals with. Mm-hmm. So it has advice to lay disciples on how to live a proper life as a Buddhist lay follower. Mm-hmm. Also advice to monastics, how to, follow the monastic path. And then one of the themes that seems to be quite special to the Sutta Nipata is the exaltation of the ideal of we call this the Muni, this is the liberated sage. Mm-hmm. So there are suttas which extol and praise, the virtues of the liberated sage.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in working so closely with the Pali Canon. Do you get a sense from that work of what the Buddha's life was like. And the reason I ask is because I was recently reading in Tricycle magazine, there was this article called The Myth of the Historical Buddha.
Yeah.
Right? And the author, you know, concludes by saying, the image of the Buddha is constantly being renewed. And what we know as the historical Buddha, in quotes, is simply the most recent work of fiction.
Yeah.
I don't know, quite a statement to make.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, like, someone like yourself who works so closely with the Pali canon, like, what do you feel comfortable or fairly confident in saying the Buddha's life was like this? Or you know, what are your thoughts on this sort of topic?
I did skim over that article. I saw it in Tricycle, and I have to say I disagreed with the conclusion that the author came to, that the historical Buddha is one more... What was the expression?
Yeah, he said historical Buddha is simply the most recent work of fiction.
The most recent work of fiction. I mean, certainly I take it that the Buddha was an actual historical person.
Yes.
And that through the Pali canon and other texts of... that belong to the genre of the early Buddhist texts, we can get some perspective on the historical Buddha. I say that there's already maybe some tendency towards an exaltation of the Buddha already taking place, even in the Nikayas. For example, maybe some of the early Buddhists felt uncomfortable with the idea that the Buddha will die a normal death like other persons. And so we have the Buddha saying that the Tathagata, if he was requested, could extend his lifespan to the end of the aeon. But we can get some idea of, you know, the Buddha's daily routine, you know, from both the Sutta Pitaka, from the Vinaya Pitaka also, his interactions with the monastic community, the problems that erupt within the monastic community, the way he deals with them, you know, the way householders come to the Buddha and ask questions.
What was the daily life of the Buddha like? Like, you know, what were some of the activities that filled his day?
Actually, what's interesting in this commentary to the Sutta Nipata that I've been working on, we get a substantial passage which gives the Buddha's daily schedule from the time he wakes up. According to this passage, he just sleeps, like we would say, probably 2 or 3 hours a night. So what takes place from the time he wakes up? After waking up, I think he spends some time first doing walking meditation.
Wow.
And then he sits down and he enters into what is called the meditative attainment of great compassion, where he extends the compassion over the world. Then he ponders, are there any beings that are in my that have need of me today that I could benefit? And so he starts sort of scanning the people in his environment to see whether there is anybody that he should go to that has a special need. And if not, then he just follows the regular daily routine of going on alms round in the morning, then giving an inspiring discourse to the monks after the midday meal, then spending the afternoon with other activities, then in the evening, the lay people from the surrounding environment or the neighborhood come to the monastery and he gives a discourse to them. Then again, in the evening, he'll spend some more time in meditation, then give another discourse to the monks later in the evening. And then in the middle of the night, late at night, when everybody else is asleep, then the devas, the deities from the different world systems come to visit the Buddha. And then the Buddha gives them instruction.
He teaches them, so they're like the night shift.
Exactly, the night shift. Because we get a large selection of texts, particularly in the first part of the Samyutta Nikaya, which are the Buddha's teachings to the deities.
How fascinating, a day in the life of the Buddha.
Yeah. That's nice. This is the Buddha's daily routine.
And the start of the day, it feels very like, almost like bodhisattva like mentality, right? How can I help people?
Interesting.
And starting with walking meditation.
I believe he does the walking meditation after waking up.
And then a meditation on compassion.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, quite a few suttas begin by saying that very early in the morning, just, you know, before dawn, the Buddha enters the meditation on great compassion. Then he sees that there's a particular farmer here who is just ripe, whose conditions have come together and is ripe for, you know, some realization. So the Buddha will go to him. Or he sees that there's a particular Brahmin here who needs his help, and he'll go to that.
It's interesting that one of the things that interests me is that there's all these different types of meditations, right?
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about the word meditation.
Yeah.
And so, for example, maybe I won't use this analogy, but people talk about like Eskimo and snow. Like they have so many words for snow. But like, you know, I grew up surfing, and so I can... We have so many different words for different types of waves.
Right.
And so then Buddhists seem to have all these different words that we translate it in as meditation.
Yeah.
So for example, the Sanskrit, which I'm more familiar with, like the samadhi, jnana, bhavana.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, what are the different words the Buddha used for meditation, and what are the intricacies of those words, like samadhi and jhana? What's the difference?
Okay, this is quite a big topic. Okay, so the word that would signify the process of cultivating meditation, or meditation as a process of cultivation, that word would be bhavana, which is the word that is translated into English as development or cultivation, or sometimes simply as meditation. Okay, then we have what are taken to be like the two main streams of meditation, which are samatha bhavana, which is the development of tranquility or serenity, and vipassana bhavana, the development of insight. And it's the development of samatha or serenity that leads to samadhi. Samadhi, in the broad sense, I translate concentration, but English is really an inadequate language for representing samadhi. And so then the jhanas are considered states, advanced states of samadhi, of concentration. And then it's the development of vipassana that leads to panya, or wisdom. But when vipassana reaches a certain intensity of development, it also brings along its own type of samadhi. Sometimes it's called vipassana samadhi. So this is the concentration in which the focus is not on a single unchanging object, as in the jhana concentration, but the mind is focused upon the changing stream of experience, but without wavering or distraction. And then that brings the insight into the three characteristics.
Yeah, so it's bhavana that's divided into shamatha and vipassana. But then there's a certain type of, and there's a certain type of vipassana that is conjoined with samadhi.
Exactly.
But then samadhi is sort of like, which you translate as concentration, is, and then jhana has the nature of samadhi itself. It's just more refined. Would that be fair?
When the Buddha speaks about, in the Noble Eightfold Path, like what is right concentration, then he'll explain it or define it by the stock formula for the four jhanas. But I think it would be a mistake to take, to establish an equivalence between samadhi and jhana and think that through the development of insight that there is no samadhi.
And in the three trainings, like morality, concentration, wisdom, the word there in the Pali Canon, is it is the Buddha talking to samadhi there?
Yeah, when he speaks about samadhi there and other places, he uses adhicitta, the higher mind. Then that, when that is formally defined, then the formula for the four jhanas is brought in.
Okay, nice.
I have to say, I'm not sure whether he does the walking meditation immediately after waking up or in the middle, late at night. But I do... But let's say that there's a certain advantage when one is doing long-term meditation and doing walking meditation after waking up, in that if one tends to be drowsy and if one goes into sitting meditation right away, then the drowsiness will descend upon one and one will start dropping off. Whereas doing the walking meditation after waking up invigorates the mind. So even if one does like 15 minutes of walking meditation invigorates the mind enough so that then when one sits down, drowsiness will not descend.
Okay, that's interesting. Actually, it brings up another question for me. So this like walking meditation and then this general practice of mindfulness, which is popular today and is defined as non-judgmental awareness. So this idea of this type of mindfulness, how does it relate to what the Buddha taught in terms of meditation?
Yeah, I don't recall seeing any place in the Pali Canon or in the commentaries which explain mindfulness as being non-judgmental. In fact, there's a certain ambiguity about the word judgmental. One, and this is maybe where the problem comes in, one is passing judgments upon oneself and other people, like I'm doing fine, I'm doing badly, I'm a great meditator, oh, I'm a hopeless meditator, this person is behaving in a reckless way, that person is terrible. Okay.
That's
this is a great judgment. Person, I should try to follow that person. Those are what I would call maybe person-based prejudicial judgments. So when, of course, when one is developing meditative mindfulness, one should not engage in those types of judgments. And if they arise, one just treats them as mental states to be noted and dropped. But the practice of mindfulness, as the Buddha taught it, goes hand in hand with another quality, which is called, the Pali word is sampajanya, which I translate as clear comprehension. Some use
introspection clear, or something like that.
I think at least Alan Wallace uses introspection based on the Tibetan rendering of that word. So this is where one monitors one's mental states in order to be able to assess what are wholesome states, what are unwholesome states, what are states that are, you know, detrimental to one's development, what are states that are conducive or beneficial for one's development. And over those states, one should be, should have the capacity for judging those states in order to determine what should be dropped, what should be intensified, what should be, you know, pursued, what should be discarded. So one exercises a kind of moral judgment when one is doing the meditative mindfulness upon one's states of mind, but not built, like I say, not building up person-centered or I-centered judgments upon oneself or on other people based on one's own inner states of mind.
Yeah, and I imagine like Vipassana, for example.
Yeah.
Certainly, if you're doing Vipassana meditation, you need some type of, we might not call it judgment, but ascertainment, like samnya or something like that.
Exactly, exactly.
So that mental activity has to be operating at that point.
Yeah.
To do Vipassana meditation.
Yeah. In fact, one uses terms in Pali like tirana, which is scrutinizing, and another word, tulana. Another word which I've rendered, now the Pali word escapes me, I've rendered assessment, making assessments.
Okay.
Both of the moral quality of one's mental states and also of the actual nature of things, particularly in terms of being impermanent, bound up with dukkha, and as being non-self. So tirana, tulana is what I render assessment, and tirana is evaluation or scrutinization.
Yeah. So we can say that meditation definitely incorporates these sort of mental activities.
Yeah.
In terms of what are virtuous mental states and what are non-virtuous mental states. And actually in meditation, that's the work we are doing. And so if we take that, you know, we make a distinction between meditation and mindfulness, and in mindfulness, if we use the, you know, what the popular definition of mindfulness is, non-judgmental awareness, you can take that too far, the non-judgmental aspect of it.
So I would say mindfulness is certainly what one of the key ingredients in meditation practice, and as mindfulness is practiced within the context of the Buddhist system of meditation, it as I said, it goes hand in hand with clear comprehension, yep, or sampajanya. And that involves this assessment and evaluation of one's mental states.
And then when you're talking about mindfulness here, you're actually talking about the Pali word sati, yeah?
That's sati,
yeah. And then what does, so then if we talk about sati and say, well, what's the work of sati? What is sati doing? How would you answer that? What if we say, what's mindfulness and what's sati?
Yeah. The way I've tried to express this to myself is to say that sati, I call it a bending back of the stream of awareness back upon oneself, upon one's own immediate concrete experience, physical and mental experience, in order to bring clarity to that experience. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that sati is what keeps the object present before one's attention. Mm. Or even we could maybe render sati as attentiveness.
Attentiveness.
Not attention. Yep. Attention is turning,
yes,
the mind towards the object, but retaining. In fact, the Pali uses the word dharana to explain sati. Dharana means retaining or preserving, mm-hmm, keeping the object in mind. Mm-hmm. So that is the function of sati, whereas sampajanya is what involves this activity of assessment, mm-hmm, and evaluation.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about sati and also sampajanya, and this discernment and ascertainment, where does these non-dual meditative states fit into that sort of conceptual structure? Is that fair?
You know, I haven't found anything quite corresponding to that within the system of meditative experiences or attainments that are mentioned within the Pali canon. There is there are mentioned within the Pali canon three like very high states of samadhi, which are not actually defined within the Pali canon itself. One is called the One gets this also in, particularly, I think, in the Mahayana Sutras, sort of put a lot of emphasis on these or mention them often as well. The Animitta Samadhi, which is the signless or markless concentration. Sunyata Samadhi, which is the concentration on emptiness. And the Appanihita, or Sanskrit Appanihita Samadhi, which is the undirected or desireless, wishless concentration. So maybe the non-dual samadhi evolves out of those concepts. But one doesn't find any explicit mention within the Pali canon of, it would be Advaya samadhi, but one doesn't find that, I don't think one finds that expression there.
So the jhana states are described as dualistic then?
It's not dualistic, but within the jhanic state, a distinction would be made between the object of concentration and the mind and mental factors that are focused on that object of concentration. But it doesn't say this is a dualistic concentration.
Yeah, but from a phenomenological standpoint,
yeah.
So after the fact, we can talk about subject and object, and the mental factors being distinct from the object.
Yeah, yeah.
But phenomenologically, at the moment, is it described as a, is there still subject object at that point?
What's interesting in the suttas is that when the jhanas are explained, the objective content of the jhana is not mentioned, but the jhanas are always defined in terms of what are the particular mental factors that constitute that jhana. So it says, for example, one enters and dwells in the first jhana, which has vitaka and vichara, thought and examination, and which has the piti and so piti sukha, vivekajang piti sukhang, joy and bliss born of detachment.
What about the fifth factor? So the fifth factor What is the Pali?
The fifth factor is citta-ekagata, which is one-pointedness of mind.
So that one-pointedness of mind.
Yeah.
So it feels like to me that phenomenologically, the mental activity that will distinguish between subject and object may not be operating, even though that's what is described as a non-dualistic state. But I don't know if that's fair.
Okay, the one-pointedness of mind means that the mind is, let's say, focused one-pointedly upon the object without wavering. So the object, or the opposite of citta-ekagata, one-pointedness of mind, would be vikalpa, distraction, mental distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Within the jhana, the maybe this is where the non-dual samadhi comes from.
Yeah.
Within the jhana, the meditator will not be distinguishing this is the mind, that is the object.
Yes.
But it's just, maybe you could say a non-dualistic or non-discriminatory experience.
Yeah.
But on reflection, retrospection, then the meditator will distinguish that is the object, that is the mind and mental
And that's
factors.
Exactly how Tsongkhapa in the Gelugpa, Tibetan Buddhism Gelugpa explains non-dual experiences.
Tsongkhapa.
So he will say, on reflection, you can make a distinction between subject and object.
Yeah.
It's just in the moment, it's experienced as non-dual.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. All right. Thank you so much. It's such an honor to have you back on the Wisdom Podcast.
Okay.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Bhikkhu Bodhi. Next episode, we are joined by Stephen Armstrong, senior Vipassana teacher and editor of the new book, Manual of Insight by Mahasi Sayadaw.
And about the third or fourth day into the retreat, I just got this feeling. It was just a feeling. You know what? I don't want to live like this. I don't want to live this middle class, acquisitive, treadmill life.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do it. And instantly, it wasn't like I had to reflect on it or make a decision or anything. It's just like, I'm going. I'm done. I'm going. Now I had some understanding. I had a little more practice. I had a little more Dharma understanding. And, you know, I went back home at the end of that retreat and told my partner at the time, I'm sorry. I'm going to Burma.